So if, like me, you were a child of the 80s, one of the biggest shows of the decade was Dempsey and Makepeace. And one of the stars of the show, Michael Brandon, is off telling his story around the country in his one-man show, Off Ramps, and he's joining me now.
Hey, Dan.
Hey, Michael, how are you?
I'm good. Good to be here.
Yeah, thanks for joining me. Thanks. So you've just done the show in Richmond and Epsom in
the last week
or so, and you did the show in Edinburgh before.
Well, yeah, in Edinburgh I was trying it out. It was kind of an experiment, like Fringe.
Mm-hmm.
It was a much shorter show. And, similar stories, but, you know, then embellishing and adding in more stuff, photos and film clips and news stuff, Super 8 footage, you know, recently discovered. So, it's expanded the show to something new, a two-act stand-up story.
And it's the story of your life, really, growing up in New York and
yeah,
becoming an actor.
Yeah, I could tell the story of your life, but, you know, I don't know if it would be that interesting for me to tell it. It would be better if you told it, you know what I mean?
Fair enough, point taken. But what inspired you to put it together as a show in the first place?
I suppose two things. One, people who I've worked with who said I should do stand-up, like Rob Reiner and George Burns,
mm-hmm.
and... you know, going back years, that was in the 70s. Rob Reiner was the star of All in the Family, which is an old 70s show, I think it was.
Okay.
And he was also directed Princess Bride, and, you know, it was a lot of stuff. And I met him. He was at that time married to Penny Marshall, who was Shirley, I think, and Laverne and Shirley.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Okay. Anyway, we were on a holiday. We bumped into each other on an island and in Hawaii, and goes back into the mid 70s. And what happened was, you know, we had a lot of funny situations, and I noticed he didn't laugh. And I said, "What's the story with you?" I said, "You know, you don't laugh." He said, "I'm a comedian." I said, "I don't get it." He said, "Comedians say that's funny. We don't laugh." So it became a mission of mine to make this guy laugh.
Brilliant.
And one day it happened. I can't remember the story or the joke or whatever, but he fell on the floor in a restaurant. He was in fits of laughter. He was crying. And I thought that was mission accomplished. Then about a year or 2 years later, I'm in a car. I'm doing a PR thing for a movie, and I was in New York, and I see him come out of a supermarket with two bags in his arms, and I just did the punchline as I drove by, something like, "Doctor!" I don't know what it was, but anyway, he dropped the bags and fell on the sidewalk. You know. Anyway, Rob said, "You should do stand-up." And then I worked with George Burns in the Comedy Company. That was a film I did in the 70s as well. It was a 2.5-hour TV special about comedians. And we had a great time, really connected. And he said, "Kid, you should do stand-up." So anyway, that was that. That's a one part of it. The
mm-hmm.
other part is that I'm working on a book that I hope to find a publisher for, which is those stories.
Okay.
Because I've had the great fortune to meet and know amazing people in my life, work with them or, you know, have relationships with them or be friends with them. And these stories are, you know, I couldn't fit in two shows, in three shows. I couldn't put them all in. That's the problem. The hardest problem I had with my show was cutting it down so that it was a doable length because there's so many stories.
Yeah.
So that's why it should be a book. And I was taking, what I did was I took just some pieces from it, like kind of best bits, whatever, or bits that apply, and went and did the Fringe.
And Off Ramps was born.
And Off Ramps was born, yeah, exactly. And the people responded to the stories, and a lot of the stuff from when we did it at Richmond was that I couldn't believe it. They said, "More, more, more."
Mm.
And, you know, you think, "Oh, my God, I'm going to bore these people. I'm going to put them in comas talking for so long." But they love the stories. And, you know, and it helps when you've got, you know, I've got my own photographs and my own, you know, clips and footage to go with the story. So
I think what was interesting from an audience point of view, I was there in Richmond, obviously, with you, is that the style in which you put the story across, as well as the interesting points of the story, I mean, I could have sat there for probably all night and carried on listening, and I think most of the audience would have felt the same.
Well, thank you. I mean, that is a great compliment, and it's wonderful to hear. See, I think it goes back. My father was a storyteller. He used to crack people up. He was a funny guy. And in fact, I'll tell you, one of the things that comes back to it now that you bring me to this, there was a guy who was an editor of the Times magazine, London Times. And when my father passed away, I wrote a story called God's Laughing Now, right? And I sent it to him. And he called me up and he said, can we meet for lunch? And I met him for lunch, and he slid my story, you know, back across the table. And he said, this is not an article, because I sent it in for Relations, which is an article they still do in the Times magazine. Okay. And he said, I said, it's not. I was so disappointed. He said, no, it's better than that. It's a book. You should write a book. And I said, well, I don't think there's enough in that story for a book. He said, no, that's the chapter of in a book.
Yeah.
Write the book, because, and write it just the way you talk, because this is great stuff. And so that was the chapter on my dad, God's Laughing Now. And that's what I said at his funeral service. You know, I said, you know, when the next time you hear thunder, it could be God's Laughing Now. Because, you know, he was a funny man. And I thank him for inheriting that. You know, that's the good part of my father. I tell other stories, of course, which are quite dramatic in my growing up with my dad, because he was the gutter Confucius, as I referred to him, you know, street smart. But that goes back. That's how I started to write these stories and put them down on paper and you know, write them in the computer and start with the book. And from that was born the show.
You start the story. In fact, most of the story is kind of pre-Dempsey Makepeace, isn't it? And actually, I was blown away by the sort of body of work that you did. I thought I knew your career reasonably well, but actually you had done loads before.
I can't even remember a lot of the stuff I did. You know, I mean, it's like 50 years. When you're talking 50 years in business, you know, and you do a lot of things, there are so many TV movies or episodes or specials or things that went on that it's impossible to compile it all, you know.
Yeah.
You just grab a few bits, but there's stories connected to everything. So, you know, you go to do that, you film this, you meet that person. You know, there was, in the very, very beginning, there was my first job, I think an agent sent me for, was a movie with Patty Duke called Me, Natalie. And me and there's an unknown guy, it was Al Pacino.
Okay.
And it was like a line. It was like one line in the movie, and we were both there, unknown guys, and so what they didn't know what to do, and so they went on who signed the contract first, and that was it, and, you know, so Al got the line, and they bought me lunch.
Fair enough. One of the stories that sort of stood out, I don't want to give too many spoilers away so people come and see the show, but it was sort of how you got into acting was one of my favorite stories from the show.
I know people find that hard to believe, actually. But it's you can't make that up. That was, you know, that's the truth. You know, because I was a kid who didn't know what he couldn't do, and that I think was the basis of my starting out on that road. It was like I didn't know. So if you don't know, you just go for it, and you just kind of cut your own path, you know, through the jungle until you find a light.
I was just really fascinated by your drive once you kind of found what it is you thought your sort of path.
I think that's a key thing in youth today, and also in the special needs world. When they find something that they enjoy, they latch onto, that life changes at that point. You know, otherwise we kind of drift, and I was kind of a lost soul, or drifting in the, you know, out there, treading water. I didn't know what to do. And I was doing this, I was doing that, and, you know, going for that career, and I was just really confused. And now, you know, a lot of kids today, they know what they want to do. They go for it, and they do it. But a lot don't. And they have to find it. And it's hard, and I hope that they do, because, you know, for the ones that don't, you sometimes take jobs where you think you don't have a choice. And you got to remember, you always have a choice.
You talked about children with special needs. I know that you and your wife, Glynis, are patrons of the Autism Trust.
Yes, we are.
So how did that come
we
about?
We were also involved with other things. But, it's like because you try to give back. And also, the thing about autism is like when, 20 years ago, it was one in thousands.
Mm.
And today, it's like one in 50, one in 20. So there's something going on in the world that you cannot ignore, and it needs to have attention, and that's why we got involved. So when we did some silly show, what was it, Married, or one of those things where they ask you questions?
Oh, yeah. Was it Mr. and Mrs., was it?
Yeah, something like that, yeah. Celebrity Mr. and Mrs., yeah. It was a goof. And the great thing was we raised a whole lot of money for the Autism Trust.
Mm.
And so that, it's like giving back. I try to do that also with, I teach meditation, and I teach it in prison.
Okay.
And so that, for me, is a way of giving back and also getting a lot of self-valuation. It's valuable. And I, because I used to get angry about people committing crimes and things that were done, injustice and stuff like that. But I thought, where can I have an effect? And so I've taught in many prisons in America and also several here. And it's always very valuable work.
Well, and I absolutely commend you both. My day job, I've worked with a lot of children with autism and as well as people with mental health issues and various other things. So having sort of voices out there that will help sort of get people talking and get people sort of understanding the message
that's
is really
very
useful.
Good, Dan. It's glad to hear. Because, the Thomas the Tank thing seems to reach a lot of those children.
It does, absolutely.
They respond in a very special way. In fact, I was at a dinner party, and there was a boy. He was autistic. He was on a computer at the end of the room, the other end of the room, and I was having a dinner party with his parents, who were friends, and we were talking. He kept looking at me. And then about halfway through the dinner party, he walked up to me and he went, Thomas the Tank. And it was like, because he listens, and he knew my voice.
Yeah.
And that was pretty amazing.
I have to talk to you about Dempsey Makepeace, because although, it was a while back, it's still a big thing in various people I've talked to, still that's what they remember you for.
It was enormous in the UK, France, Poland, Eastern Europe, it was worldwide. It was in 75 different countries. Then to have 20 million viewers, you can't get 20 million views now. It's impossible, it was enormous, and it only ran once. That's the amazing thing on terrestrial television. And in France, it ran on every network. It was called the Series Classique. But we were the, at the time, the show, I guess, that was an American show that was comparable was with Bruce Willis and...
Moonlighting. Hmm? Moonlighting.
Moonlighting. Mm. Yeah, they say you the English Moonlighting.
Yes. It's probably not a bad comparison, actually. But it was huge. I mean, I'll absolutely confess it's probably still one of my favorite all-time programs. And back in the day, I had you had your action figures, and I think I had probably everything there was to have.
You still have it?
I don't think I do. I wish I did.
I really do wish I did. You know, it's like I had about 3,000 DC comics from when I was a kid, and then I thought, I want to get those out of the old garage because but my mama threw them out.
Oh,
I know. God,
really
that
tricky,
was like it was a fortune. It was like, but nobody knew then that those kind of things, would have a value. And
I've had that discussion many times, and actually, there's a part of me thinking, I don't think as a kid, even if someone had told me this could be worth a fortune in years to come, I wouldn't want to have played with it. I had the toy. I wanted to do something with it. I didn't want to just keep it in a box.
Yeah, I was never saving, it's like I always chucked out the box and just the toy wore it out,
Yeah.
But the DC Comics was like, it was the only contest I ever won was a DC Comic contest back in, God, what was I, 12? It was like so many years ago. And I think I wrote a poem. Always read in good light. Read DC Comics. They shine out bright. And I won a football. I couldn't believe it. It actually came. There was this box came with a football. Wow. Congratulations, you won the contest. You know, that was amazing.
Dropping back to Dempsey and Makepeace then, I also loved, you told a couple of stories within Off Ramps. But
You could do a whole show. You know that. I mean, you could do a whole show on the 3 years of all the episodes and the different things that happened, the accidents that happened, the stunts that went wrong,
That was what I was going to talk to you about, because I suppose you sort of, if you look back with kind of modern standards and health and safety and things, actually, there didn't seem to be any.
You're right. They would never get away with that. I mean, but then people do get away with whatever they can until they can't. You do the tips and tails of it and that kind of thing. But when we did Dempsey and Makepeace, I was hanging from a helicopter that had taken me about 15, 20 feet into the air above a rooftop.
Mm.
And, and then it was just going to take you up a bit and then come down a bit, you know. And then Valentino, my stunt double, when it went off the building and flew around, you know, he was hooked up to it, you know. But,
But like you won't
even get to do those bits.
You were in a crusher. You were... is there a story that there was a special effects, an explosion or something, and everyone else was miles away, and you and Glynis were going, why are you all over there?
Did I tell that story?
I think I've seen it on another interview with you.
Yeah, that one was in there. There was, I had to cut it down, and there were so many good stories that had to go. But that one, I remember they said, okay, we're standing there about to say action. And we said, hold on. What's wrong? Just want to know exactly what's going to happen here. Oh, the door's just going to, fall in. It'll be a puff of smoke. Right. Nothing real.
Hmm.
Right. We go back and I said, well, excuse me, what is it now? Well, how come you're all standing 100 yards away behind a plexiglass shield? If this is the puff. I said, could we see a demonstration? Well, not only did the door go in, but the entire set was blown to the ground.
Wow.
The London bomb squad, the military helicopters, everybody was out. It was like, we would have been gone. Dempsey and Makepeace, puff of smoke.
Wow. And again, you look at one of the most iconic scenes I always picture. It was used in the opening credits. I think it was from, is it Cry God for Harry? That episode where you're up by the door and then a spike comes through the door.
Oh, when the spear came through the door?
Yeah.
I said, where is that? Yeah, they drew a circle. They said, it should come through here.
Should.
It should. Right. I mean, if the guy's off, he's going to take my nose off, or he's going to stab me in the ear or something like that.
Because it comes through with proper force.
Valentino, I remember his mother had his mother had an Italian restaurant. And when we would start the next season over, I'd always call Val and I'd say, how much you weigh? And he said, how much do you weigh? I said, no, I asked first. And because he tended to, mangiare in mama's restaurant, and so I said, look, I'm supposed to look like Errol Flynn, not Johnny Vegas, so he would he pulled the whole chandelier out of the ceiling one time. He said, okay, I'm on a diet.
you made the comparison with moonlighting earlier, and I think that was another part of the charm of Dempsey and Makepeace, was the whole will they won't they kind
well,
of
I think that's the
it.
Thing that makes a series different from any other series is the chemistry.
Mm.
Otherwise, we've all seen a million cop shows,
But there was also that, I remember as a fan at the time, all of the press stories about you liked each other, you didn't like each other, you were together, you weren't together. And I think it was the story that everyone wanted wasn't so much Dempsey and Makepeace getting together, but you and Glynis getting together, which of course did happen.
Well, yeah, but it didn't happen because of the press. But they invented us, and we were working. We were working long days, long hours, and you just didn't get to see anybody else, So as time would have it, I mean, it's an occupational hazard. that I have now turned into a 29-year marriage.
That's a great story, a great, great story. I should hate you, really, because she was my first crush. I'm probably not the only person.
I feel a general hate out there, I have to say. You know,
but
a lot of guys out there go, you know. But
if there was anyone I was going to lose her to, it was you. That was the only person I was okay with. So, excellent. Just go back then to off ramps. I believe the sort of plan is to do a few more shows a bit later in the year, perhaps.
Well, we're thinking about doing some more later in the year. We're going to think about a tour of the show, but we'll do probably half dozen shows in October. Because it all keeps it shaping up and making it better and putting more in and getting more content and stuff like that. So it's a work always in progress. Yes, and so we got what we wanted. It couldn't have gone better in Richmond. The show took off. The people were, it was like surfing, you know, and having the perfect wave. They were there for every story, every funny situation, every poignant moment. And that was all very rewarding, and it was a joy for me to play and to do and to say. And all of it just, it couldn't have gone better, that's what I'm saying. So that's what we're going to take on and work from there and bring it back in the fall.
It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you. I could do it all day, but we've probably both got other things we need to be doing with our time.
Well, yeah, okay, there's things to do. I'd get on with it.
Are you doing anything else between now and sort of October? Any more filming planned in?
Well, I got one thing coming out with that Danny Boyle's Trust.
Oh, yes.
I did some scenes with Hilary Swank and in that, playing the U.S. Ambassador, Walter Annenberg. And that was a nice shoot. And then I've got another play that I'm talking to a director about right now. And then I've got some reading to do. And I've got meetings with my agents who I couldn't even have the time to meet with because this was so consuming doing off ramps, you know. But now it's back in life, as they say, you know.
Yeah,
that's what an actor does. He works, and then all of a sudden you're back to being the superintendent of your life again. It's like all those things you didn't do.
You've just finished with Episodes as well, which is another thing a lot of people will know.
I know, and I really, you know, I'm sorry to see that go. The last season was the best season, I thought, and it was just Elliot Salad was a wonderful character. I really enjoyed playing.
And the other thing, most recent, well, in the last few years, you did Doctor Who, and you also did Mr. Selfridge, playing.
Yeah, Mr. Selfridge, Tracy Ullman.
Of course.
Yeah, Catherine Tate. They were wonderful, wonderful shows. I'd like to do all more of them. I know Tracy's going on. She's doing more. I did two of her series. One was Breaking the News, and the other one was the Tracy Ullman show. Fabulous stuff that she comes up with, you know. Yeah.
So you're going to have off ramps too. You're going to have the whole next part of the story to tell at some point.
Well, that's true. There's 20 more years, you know, to add into that. But what do? You do one night one story, one night the other story. I don't know how to, you know. It's just like you have to. I guess after I exhaust doing the first one, you know, then we can always look at another off ramp.
Yes.
There's always other off-ramps.
There always is. So thank you so much, Michael, for joining me.
All right, Dan, thank you.
If you've enjoyed this podcast, why not keep up to date with The Sound of Surrey by listening live at brooklandsradio.co.uk or through our free mobile app.